You are listening to a renowned safety expert, Dr. Jay Allen. Dr. Jay Allen on Safety FM. This episode of the broadcast and the podcast is brought to you by Safety Focus Moments. They're consultants that want to help you get the safety culture you've been looking for. For more information, go to safetyfocusmoment.com.
Well, hello and welcome to Safety FM. I know, new intro. I know, sort of different. I like it. Anyways, how are you? Hopefully you're enjoying this holiday season. Today we have Carrie Usray. Carrie Usray is a process improvement leader and manager of professional services. He has a lot of accolades and his background is pretty extensive. He has been a speaker and a presenter at the ASSC, also part of the National Safety Congress. Today we discuss his story on how he got involved in safety and where his career has led him up to this point. Enjoy today's conversation here on Safety FM.
SafetyFM.com.
Hello and welcome to Safety FM. And on the line, I have Carrie Usray here. How are you doing today?
Excellent, Jay. Thank you.
So we have met recently at a American Society of Safety Professional meetings that they actually had in Orlando, and you did a presentation. And you spoke a little bit about safety and you spoke about human organizational performance. And that kind of got me excited and I wanted to get you on. So I'd normally like to ask people starting off, how did you get into the path of safety?
Sure. It was an interesting one. So my background is I was in the United States Navy. I was in the nuclear power program. And when I got out of the Navy, they were building a power plant near me. So it kind of worked out really good. I mean, it was from, they're building it from the ground up. So I got in early and we kind of had some training sessions. So I kind of leapfrogged positionally within the organization to run the plant because of my experience in the Navy. And then I had a turning point. I could either go to be a shift supervisor, but that was shift work, or I could go EHS and go to DAZE. So it actually worked out really well. And I've been in safety ever since. So I did a lot of environmental health and safety when I was at the power plant. I did that for about 13 years. And I really wanted to do safety more than environmental. So I had a position open up at a construction company. So I went and did that. I was a business unit safety director. And that was all pretty much mostly safety. I had a little bit of environmental, but it was mostly safety. And that's when I got introduced to the company I work with now, and I've been with them for about 12 years. So that's kind of my background when it comes to safety. So, and I, along the way, I've joined different organizations and done a lot externally. So I was in, when I was at the power plant, I was with the Voluntary Protection Program. We were a star site, and I did a lot of work with VPPPA. And I work with OSHA as a special government employee, so I get to go do some of the on-site visits. And then when I moved here to Florida, I got involved a lot with the ASSE, now it's the ASSP, in various roles at the Central Florida chapter here in Orlando. So,
well, let me ask you a couple questions there. So going back to the very beginning of the career, so you end up leaving the Navy, and then once you actually get into environmental safety and health, what are your concepts of safety at the time? And I know that you said there was a nuclear power plant that they were building. So what are your concepts as you first walk in? What is kind of like your line level, your baseline of safety? What are you looking at in particular? What is the method that you're using?
It was interesting because, I mean, I hadn't gone to school for safety. I did the reverse career. I got the experience and then went and got the degree. So I did a lot of on-the-job training. But the great thing about the area that I was in, and especially being part of the VPPPA, was there was a lot of outreach and there was a lot of sharing of information. So we had a really good community that I could draw on. A lot of safety professionals around the area that I could really lean on and go to. But just like with anything else, my early thoughts on safety and what they are now, completely different. It was very much go and build a written program, build rules and regulations, and things like that. But I really enjoyed the VPPPA, the OSHA's Voluntary Protection Program. I really enjoyed that because it helped to put some structure in, and it helped to build some things around the safety management system. Obviously not as robust as some of the newer, you know, the Z10s or the 18001 or anything like that. But it was better than an unstructured system. There was a lot of employee involvement, which I really liked too. So early on, I saw the value in doing safety with employees instead of safety to employees. And with just one person doing safety at the entire plant, you really had to rely on that. So the command and control, interestingly enough, coming from the military, never really appealed to me to do dictating, you know, how things get done. So
that's interesting. I only say that because both of my parents were in the Marines, and I think that they went the opposite direction on that, but that's my parents. Not everybody in the military is that way. So let me just ask. So when you start going into this process where you're going, okay, well, I want to do it where I'm having more people involved. How do you get them to buy in at first? Because a lot of people probably had looked at you kind of crazy at first going, what do you mean you want me to help you? Or what do you mean they're not just putting controls in place? So how did that work out at the very beginning?
Sure. So everybody wants to have a voice. I mean, we had a safety committee early on, and that was really helpful. Again, it started off very unstructured, which is a lot of people came in and said, hey, I don't like this, I don't like that. So it was there was always that. But we also created a lot of committees that basically said, hey, we really need you to come help with this. So we built a lot of that employee involvement, and we incentivized based on participation. So like when we had these conferences, either the local conference or the national conference, we would incentivize that the more people participated, the more they had an opportunity to go to these conferences. And that was really appealed to a lot of people. Now, bear in mind, you're not going to get 100% participation. They're just people that just want to go in and do their job, and they're like, you know, I don't want to do anything extra. Doesn't mean they work unsafely. It just means they're not going to, you know, be engaged beyond the work that they do, and that's okay. You don't need 100% participation from everybody all the time. That's okay.
And I'll tell you, you know, listening you or hearing you say that, a lot of people that are, I would say, behavior-based safety would be like, no, you're absolutely wrong on that particular aspect. And I think that that's where, when you start talking about these different philosophies that there are out there now about safety, they kind of a little bit more open-minded to some extent. And I'm not saying, and I agree with you on that standpoint there of, it's not because the person's unsafe. It's that, it's kind of a weird wording, because it seems like sometimes people are not paying 100% attention to what's going on, but it's not that they're trying to be unsafe, if that makes sense.
But as you're going through your career.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as you're going through your career and you see these different aspects, and then all of a sudden you go from the power plant and then you're going into the construction side, how do you start getting involved into these larger, how do you start getting involved with these actual safety groups? How do you start getting involved where you decide that you want to be part of these chapters or these national congresses and so on?
I've always felt that the best way to learn is to seek out people that are doing things really well. Which is interesting, because I know there are a lot of professionals, not just safety, who go, they learn their trade, and then they kind of stay in their own little bubble. But to me, the things that I've learned the most are, you know, I know what I know, and I don't know what I don't know. So I'll never go beyond that unless I go out and see what other people are doing. And when I see what other people are doing, I can say, hey, this would work for me, or no, that doesn't quite work for me. And I can kind of pick and choose and go, hey, I like that. Tell me more. And I can learn from that. You can benchmark. And I don't mean benchmark metrics. I've always hated that because your injury rates and my injury rates are two completely different things. So I hate specifically benchmarking metrics, but I love to benchmark against best practices. All right, what are you doing and why are you doing it? Let me think about how that would apply to the work that I'm doing. So to me, the organizations that I've joined, it's whatever's in your area. So at the time, for me, VPP was huge in the area that I was in. And it gave me the most opportunity to meet with others and exchange information and then to go out and do more. So I've always felt engaged to go out and do that for that purpose. And it also obligates me to actually go to the meetings on a regular basis if I'm, you know, serving in a position. Because it's easy to be involved, even in ASSP. I don't know. It's going to take me some time to get used to that new acronym. When I'm not involved as an officer position, it's easy to say, oh, this month I'm busy. Oh, this month I have something going on. I'm not going to go to the meeting. And it can easily be a year or more before you go to the next meeting. So it's good to be involved, even if you're just not an officer, but in a committee or anything like that, because it kind of gets you and it builds an incentive to go and to see what's going on. So whether it's through the speakers, whether it's so engaging with other people, but you really have to ask questions, right? And say, what are you doing? How are you doing it differently? And that's how I've kind of morphed into where I'm at today, is through that kind of concept of reaching out.
Now, would you say that during these different conferences and meetings that you've been to, are you cherry picking your version of safety as you go through these, or is this you're taking other people's stuff and going, okay, let me adapt it to what I can work with? I mean, coming from the nuke industry, I would imagine that you became very familiar with human and organizational performance right away, or HP as it was called back then, because that's really, really where a lot of that information came from. So going forward, did you take that information and then kind of cherry pick from some of these other things that you did, or how did you come about with what you believe that the concepts are today?
I think it's a little of everything. The cherry picking to me is more of, wow, that's you're being very successful. You have a program. Tell me about it. And to me, it's more of a launching point. I very much dislike going and, hey, send me your program and I'll cut and paste it and put my company name in and paste it in the health and safety plan. That doesn't do anybody any good because you don't really understand it. You're not quite sure what it is, and it certainly doesn't get it out into the field, right? On what you're doing and why you're doing it. To me, it's more of whether it's somebody was doing BBS. All right, tell me about this and tell me how it works. Or somebody's doing a specific thing on their lockout tagout. All right, show me what it is and how it's different than mine. And why would you do it? Why is it better than what I'm doing? So to me, it's more exploratory. And cherry picking, I'm not taking a cursory concept. It's a launching point for me to go learn more. And to me, I've tried to, if there's a concept out there, I'm sure there's a book out there, right? And so go out and read. And that's one thing that I encourage everybody to be doing is if you're not reading, books, related to your industry on a regular basis, then start now, because that really makes a huge difference. And there's so many good books out there, and not all of them are textbook style. Those are hard to read, obviously, but there's some really good books out there. Regardless of the topic, I'm sure you can go find some.
Is there any book recently that you've read that you would recommend if it's related to safety or anything off kilter?
There's some that are really good and have stuck with me for a while. Managing the Unexpected by Wyke and Sutcliffe, one of my favorites. Whack-a-Mole by David Marks, one of my favorites. He was a little bit on the litigious side because a lot of his examples were from litigation. He was a lawyer. But the concepts are really good. there's the Just Culture there. I really liked a lot. There's a ton out there. But those are some of my favorites, certainly.
So let me ask, as you proceed on inside of your career and you're getting these different concepts, at Predictive Solutions, how do you guys come about in regards of when you're involved with a company and you're trying to implement X? How do you go about, how do you assess, how do those things start off?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because my role is process improvement leader, right? That sounds kind of funky, but basically we try to adopt technology, right, around a process. Some companies, it's a pure technological play. Just give me the technology. I know what I'm doing with it. Let me go collect my stuff and be done. Some companies want to know the best practices and want to build it out. So what we focus on mostly is basically you go out and it's more of a verification process. So through some form of checklist or questions, you're going to go out and say, are we doing this well or are we not doing it well? Or are we doing it well or is there room for improvement? And that's basically the concept that you go out and you do some verification. It can relate to everything from a behavior-based safety exchange. It could be part of a compliance inspection or observation. It can be part of a verification process. It can be part of anything along that lines. And it's really work imagined versus work in the field or versus actual work, right? So here's what we think it should be doing. Here's what it's actually doing. Is there a gap? And is that gap acceptable risk or not? So what we try to do, though, is we try to get to going out and doing that. And most companies are doing it. Whether they have some kind of checklist, they go out and they mark it up. They find things that are wrong, and then they fix them, right? And most companies, they stop there, right? They go out and they do it, they collect it, they fix it. But what most companies don't do well is actually take all that information that they're doing anyway. And this is external to injuries, right? Typically. It could be part of near misses. It could be your observation program. It could be anything along that lines. Is they don't take that information and they don't study it. They don't track it. They don't trend it. They can't sort it like you can an injury, right? So injuries, you know where it happened. You know what kind of injury it was. You know the injury causes and blah, 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 because you have a really robust incident management system. Most companies do because you have to do it. OSHA says you must do it. But when it comes to your non-injury stuff, even near misses, right, worksite observations, those don't have a robust program, right? It's not as structured, typically, as their injuries. So they can't track it. They can't trend it, right? And I'll give you a great example to test my theory there. Is you walk out under the floor, right? Let's say we're in a manufacturing environment. And there's oil on the floor. So that's unsafe. You'd clean it up, right? And you'd mark it down on your little sheet, right? And you come back the next day. There's oil on the floor. That's unsafe. You're going to clean it up. You'll mark it on your sheet. Hey, I found this. I fixed it, right? You could do that daily, right, for weeks at a time. And you're doing the right thing, right? You're finding it and you're fixing it. But what you're failing to do is to realize, every day I walk by this area, there's oil on the floor. Hey, where's that oil coming from? Maybe I should go fix the cause, right? The root cause. Hey, there's a leak in this machine. Let's fix the leak, and now I don't have to worry about the oil. And I know that's kind of a silly analogy, right? Very simplistic, and we don't live in a simplistic environment. But we do that with our worksite observations all the time. We find and fix, right? But we only address the symptoms. We are not good at addressing the causal factors. Why does this keep happening over and over? And what can we do to address it before it leads to something worse, like an injury, right? Pre-accident investigation concept Most companies are not doing it and not doing it well. So that Study Act piece is it relates to the Plan, Do, Study, Act, right? That Study Act piece is where you're going to look at your data and then act on the data. So you need to have some structure on how you're collecting it in order to drive that change, right? And that could relate to everything from your significant injury fatality controls that are in place to regular worksite observations from housekeeping to whatever, right?
I think sometimes some of the issues that we run into is that we've also set up, to incentivize some of our workers and some of our executives and some of our managers in regards of, if you have this many amount of near miss reporting, we will incentivize you X if you don't have an issue that occurs. And I think that that's where a lot of it comes from, because I will tell you, you even giving that example right there, I can almost even visualize people going, okay, I'm cleaning up the floor. This was a near miss, but nothing happened. I cleaned up the floor again, near miss, nothing happened. And they're not going to look at what the issue is that's causing it. And I mean, I know it's a terrible thing to say, but that's sometimes how some of our upper management looks at the incentive programs. And I know it's a terrible thing to say, but it's the reality of the workforce that we live in.
So as we look at the...
No, totally agreed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and that's the problem. It's like we have this vision that we want people safe, but we also have this personal gain depending on your executive level that you might be incentivized. So what's going to be more important, my personal incentive or getting somebody safe? If it's just an oil spill, and we kind of already know that it's going to happen, and it's happened before, and we're probably going to take care of it, but we're not going to take care of the problem. It's you really have to kind of juggle how that actually works. And I look at it and I go, if you go into a location or a company that has that problem, how do you address that with the upper management?
Is that a question to me?
Of course it's a question to you.
Certainly. So the interesting thing is a lot of people, is it evidence-based, right? So a lot of times when you go and you say, hey, I want capital improvement is a good example. If you don't have injuries related to it, you only have the anecdotal information related to, hey, I've talked to this person, I've talked to that person. Hey, this person reported this and it's a single near miss event. Me as a safety professional, I've gone and looked at it and here's what I think. And now you go into a meeting with a manager and you're basically saying, hey, I want you to spend, a capital improvement expenditure, which is typically could be, a small amount to a large amount. And you're saying, hey, based on this anecdotal information, I want you to spend this money. And without any evidence to back you up, right? It's going to be very difficult to persuade a manager to produce those funds, right? If I go, now let's flip that around. If I go and I have financial data, right? If I have scheduled data, right? I have evidence-based information that I can share and show, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what the problem is. If we change this, it will do this. If we had that on the safety side, right, I think we'd be able to make a change. But let's go back to management too, right? How do we measure safety, right? We'll determine how that plays out. Most companies say, I measure safety based on the lack of injuries or based on the number of injuries, right? So if you go and you say, hey, I want you to spend $50,000 to make this change. And they'll say, have we had anybody hurt in that area? No. Next. Because as long as nobody's getting hurt, obviously, then it's not a priority. Okay? We almost have to build up a string of bodies, right, in order to say, now will you make the change? Right? It's very difficult if we're measuring based on something that happens, right? That we have to wait for those things to play out in order to make a change, to justify a change. So we have to go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
No. So, if we don't go up and say, hey, if we don't start looking at the barriers in place, right? We don't say, hey, we have these things in place and these barriers are insufficient. right? And start looking at our controls that are in place and doing verifications of controls, right? Because if we measure by injuries alone, we have this misconception that we are doing things safely, and that's why we have no injury. That's a huge misconception, but it's one supported by how we measure safety today, right? Meaning if I have zero injuries, obviously I'm doing everything well. Therefore, I don't have to do anything differently, right? And that's how management sees it, because we are not giving management the tools that they need to measure safety or to do safety differently if we measure based on injuries alone.
And that's a lot of the problems that we run into. And I sit here, and as you were giving that example, I have to tell you, it came to mind a meeting that I was at, and this was with a different organization, and they had their safety director inside of this meeting, and they were really trying to acknowledge if they were going to do a recall based on how many injuries they were having compared to how much the recall was going to cost. And I was like, how could you sit here and really kind of determine if hurting somebody, injuring somebody, potentially even killing somebody, if there's a cost affected towards doing a recall or not doing the recall? So that kind of drove me crazy. And of course, it's incentive-based. And that's the problem. You mentioned the zero injuries. Absolutely. If you go in and say, let's say today that you have a program that's behavior-based safety. Nothing wrong with behavior-based safety, but you have zero injuries. But all of a sudden, you made the determination that there might be something a little bit better. And let's say, for instance, in this case, it's HOP. And you want to bring HOP in. And you say, okay, let's change the program. And it's more of not a program, but it's a philosophy, and I want to change it to this. And there's going to be X cost in regards to doing the training and changing everything out. What do you think they're going to tell you? They're probably going to tell you that you're crazy. Right. If I have zero on my scorecard, how can I make zero better? So as a safety professional, I'm going to ask you this question. How do you think we should change our scorecards? What should they look like? What should they have?
That's interesting, right? Because I have a love-hate relationship with metrics, right? I love metrics because it tells you a direction, right? Where am I compared to where I want to be? But as soon as you adopt a metric, you can game that metric, especially if you incentivize it, right? So that's my love-hate relationship with metrics. When they're used for the right reasons, I love them. When they're used for the wrong reasons, then trust me, I can pull my hair out. And based on some of the stories that I've seen where you take a metric and you say, hey, why don't you use it for this purpose? And then it gets reused or repurposed and then totally turns its on its ear, and you start driving the wrong behaviors because of it. That's what I don't like about metrics. So the whole balanced scorecard, of course, you still need to track incidents, right? You can't get around that. But they shouldn't be the end-all be-all, right? To me, an injury is only an outcome or a potential outcome, right? It's really what you should be looking at is the, and I know the leading indicator, that's the term I use for anything non-injury related. So anything up to but before an injury, to me, is a leading indicator. Because I know, hey, leading indicators, by the time they're reported, they're lagging indicators. Yes. So I define leading lagging a little differently. I define it, leading as anything that's not injury related. And anything that's injury related, obviously, is a lagging indicator. In my, that's how I determine it. So therefore, when you talk leading indicators, you have to start looking at what are we doing to build safety into our program, right? And what are we doing to actually actively do safety in our organization? Because I can achieve zero injuries and do absolutely nothing. I want to make sure that's crystal clear, because that is how most companies operate. They get these safety teams who try and go out and do safety, right? And then you get the rest of the organization with 20 other priorities, right? Including safety. And they just get, you know, safety's like, hey, I'm having no injuries, so get off my back. I've got widgets to put out the door. I've got a schedule to keep. I've got, you know, 100 people that I've got to figure out work schedules. I've got, you know, blah, 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 right? So as long as we, you know, hey, as long as I'm having no injuries, I'm fine. And when I do have an injury, well, holy crap, that means we did something different, right? And so let's go figure out what the easiest, quickest way to figure out what that different was, which could have been what you were doing every day leading up to that, obviously, right? And then figure out, oh, there's our problem. This guy didn't follow a procedure or whatever. You do some quick corrective action plan, or at least document this is what we should do for a corrective action. And we move on. It only gets weird when you start having multiple injuries and then people start scratching their head. What? You know, we're not doing anything different today than we were yesterday or the day before. Why is that happening now? And that's where it gets really interesting and very weird for companies. When they have multiple injuries or they have a significant injury, right? And it leaves people scrambling to go, you know, what can I have done to prevent this? Right? And the answer is usually, we can't keep doing what we've been doing, right? Because if you didn't see it coming, then obviously that there's a gap in your system.
And that's where some of those conversations start coming about, where they turn around and go, well, aren't all accidents preventable? If we had a better quality worker, they wouldn't have been injured. And that's when I start taking a look at those systems and going, where is the flaw in the system? Is the flaw in the system what the worker is doing? Or is the flaw in the system the upper management not understanding what safeguards need to be in place? And I know that I'm kind of going tangent based, but at the same time, just listening to some of it, it gets so frustrating at times of people not being able to understand that not everything that worked in the past is going to work in the future. And as we move forward with these different concepts of safety, and I know that some of these programs that have been instilled in some of these companies have cost small fortunes just to be able to put them into place. I look at it and go, what can we do moving forward and say, okay, boom, we can do this and maybe implement a change within the organization. Because I have to tell you, the moment that you start talking about HOP and you tell somebody it's a philosophy and that it's not a program, I always like to see their face, because it's always amazing that initial look of shock of, what do you mean? So now I don't have the sheet that I'm going to fill out and it's going to tell me everything that I'm supposed to do step by step. And it's like, no, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do learning teams and we're going to learn more about the organization and if something goes wrong. And it's, I always like having those conversations, because then you go, what do we do moving forward? So when your company comes in and starts doing some of these process improvements, is everything based on an app, or are they able, when you go in, is it app based mostly, or is it program based, or how do they go about doing some of the concepts?
So it is certainly app based, right? So for example, you could build a checklist, right? And that checklist could be, whether it's a BBS checklist, a compliance checklist, any kind of checklist that you want to go out and verify a process or observe a work task. So the companies build these checklists, right? And they're already using them, right? They're going out and saying, hey, good, bad, whatever. So the apps are there because the reason they're there is because they had some kind of way or methodology to do it on paper previously. So they want to kind of digitize it. And that's usually when they come to us. Like, we have all this paper, but we're a large organization. We have all this paper, and at best, companies or projects are putting this in an Excel spreadsheet to kind of track and trend it. So you can't really roll the data up. You can't really see where, you know, any historical information. You can't talk from one group to the next, especially at the corporate level, right? So if you ask somebody, hey, what's my incident rate? You can get it at the company level. You can get it at the regional level. You can get it at the project level. Boom, 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 right? But if you ask them, hey, show me your observation data metrics across the company, across the region, across each project, they wouldn't be able to do that usually. So that's usually when they come to us, is they want some of that transparency and visibility into what's going on in the field. You know, what are we seeing? And can we use that information to then be proactive in our prevention efforts, right? So that's usually what gets them to come to us. And then what we found is, and that's why I'm kind of migrating toward the HOP principles, is imagine people are collecting these observations, right? And you start to find these at risk or opportunities for improvement, right? So you go out and you say, hey, this guy's not tied off, or hey, this guy did a lockout tagout without, testing the machine before he started loop on it. He locked it out, but he didn't test it. You know, whatever it is. And it's like, whoa, that's kind of a wow, right? I'm glad we caught this before it led to an injury. And now people start treating these findings as if they were an injury. I don't want injuries. I don't want bad things to happen, right? I once had an operations manager at the end of a big training stand up and say, I expect everybody to be 100% safe, right? Which means what he just put out there is, I don't want to see any deviations from expectations, right? Which means you now have no proactive data to act upon, because he basically said, I don't want to see it. I don't expect to see it. Don't tell me about it. So that leads you into the HOP principles, which is error is normal, right? So the expectation of somebody being fallible should be expected, and I want to know about it, because I can't manage that risk if I don't know about it. So early on, we saw, and we even ran a predictive model, and one of the biggest factors that led to locations that had a high number of injuries were the ones that said nothing's ever wrong. Does that make sense, Jay?
Oh, absolutely.
Basically, the locations that were always 100% safe, right, never had anything to report proactively, were the ones that had a high number of injuries, right? So that's kind of interesting, because basically the more you can find these deviations, right, and have people speak up, and more importantly, you connect the dots and then say, wow, if this has happened more than one time, right, it's a systemic issue. Now let's put that learning team together and say, we're having this issue. What can we do to make it so we can avoid an injury, or what can we do to make it better, right? So now you have this team that can get together. You bring in the workers, you bring in the operations team, you bring in safety, and you say, let's brainstorm it, right? Let's put something in place, and then let's track this change to see, is it making a difference or not? And that's really how I see the progression of safety is, you know, you target, just like treating cancer, right? You want to target where the issue is, and then you want to go apply your change, and then you want to measure, did it get better, right? So instead of waiting for somebody to die and go, hey, probably should have checked for cancer, you want to go out and proactively find it and address it, right?
Now, Carrie, if the listeners want to know more about you or about about predictive solutions, what do they need to do?
Yeah, so Predictive Solutions, we're a software as a service company. The easiest thing to do is go to predictivesolutions.com. We have a lot of case studies on there, some white papers, and some shows you kind of what we do. And the interesting thing that we do a little differently is my team, I'm the manager of professional services at Predictive Solutions. And my team, we're all safety professionals. Every one of us has served in a both as site safety and as a higher level function safety within an organization. So my company brings real life work experience to the application of this technology. And the technology is designed to allow you to collect information proactively, right? And then use that data to drive improvement. So we bring together that the process improvement and the basically that safety experience. We bring that to bear to help you develop if you don't already have, or to sustain and improve your basically your leading indicator program, whether that's worksite observations, whether that's BBS, whether that's, you know, verification of controls when you're doing work on SIF. any of those types of things, we help to put a program around it so that you can track and trend it and drive improvement proactively. So, but again, the website's the easiest way to go and look this up. And we have a blog that has a lot of things related to leading indicators, related to that kind of work as well. So we do a lot of articles around that as well.
And what is that web address?
PredictiveSolutions.com has the blog. There's a link within that website. So there's, it's menu driven, so you can kind of go look and find case studies in the blog and all kinds of stuff like that.
Okay. Well, Kerry, I do appreciate you actually coming on to Safety FM.
Absolutely, Jay. Thank you for the opportunity. It's good talking to you as always.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, JLM.
Join the fun on social media and find us on Facebook at Safety FM.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do-it-yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.